You introduced some terms that I found interesting, and some of them I'm familiar with, some of them less so. So you talk about black swans, and then you talk about dragon kings, as opposed to the chaos kings that you write about in the book. Can you tell us what they are?
Yeah, dragon kings is a term created by this French mathematician, physicist, Didier Sornet. And it's his version of the black swan. He came up with it after the Black Swan book came out. He didn't like the black swan. He thinks that the concept provides risk takers an excuse when things go contrary to what they expected. That, oh, it was a black swan. I could never have seen it. This was totally unexpected. What Didier claims is that, no, actually these things are predictable in using very complicated math. And he's designed strategies that he claims can predict when something is entering a bubble, which prevailing economic theory claims that you cannot predict when something is in a bubble. You can only see it after it's popped.
Welcome to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. How to make it, save it, keep it. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question. What it means to live a rich life beyond money. My guests share their practices, principles, and evergreen wisdom. I'm your host, Bogumil Baranowski, author, TEDx speaker, investor, and a founding partner of Sicard Associates, a boutique investment firm founded in New York City. Join me on this quest to unearth the wisdom of the ages. Welcome, everyone. I'm so glad you're tuning into my podcast. For your convenience, the show is available on a multitude of platforms, including Spotify, Apple, Google, Audible, and many more. If you want to keep up with all new episodes, and there's so many more in the queue, make sure you subscribe and please do share it with friends and family. Review it and rate it if you can. Every little gesture matters, and I thank you for it. If you'd like to know more about me, or if you're interested in getting in touch, simply Google my name and it will lead you straight to my website. There's a contact form there, or check notes to this episode for links. I love hearing how you listen to my podcast on your walks, hikes, alone times, drives, trips, and more. I trust that my guests and I are a wonderful company on those adventures. I also enjoy reading how some of you are rehearsing and answering some questions that I ask my guests. I love hearing that. If you're new to the show, please scroll down and check out all the amazing guests I've had over the last few months. If you are serious about investing, money wisdom, wealth, and living a better life, you'll find plenty of episodes with some incredible ideas. For those who enjoy reading thoughtful pieces, I regularly write articles on Substack, which I'm sure you'd find insightful. Find me there and follow me as well. Finally, I'd like to mention my latest book, Crisis Investing. It's a collection of 100 essays that I penned for our clients during the tumultuous times of the global COVID pandemic. These essays are both timely and timeless, providing a unique perspective on navigating through crises. They were never meant to be published, but here they are available to you. Please find the book on Amazon. The book has already received considerable recognition and much love, ranking among the top releases on Amazon in its initial weeks. Thank you for your support and for being a part of my listener community. Now, without further ado, let's dive into today's episode. My guest today is Scott Patterson. He's the author of the New York Times bestselling book, The Quants and Dark Pools, and a staff reporter for the Wall Street Journal, where he has written about hedge funds, high-speed trading, Warren Buffett, the global mining industry, and climate change. He's a winner of the Loeb Breaking News Award. Scott has made frequent appearances in the media, including on CNBC, The Daily Show, and Fresh Air. His work has also appeared in the New York Times, Rolling Stone, and Mother Earth News. He has a Master's of Arts from the James Madison University. Today, we focus on his newest book, Chaos Kings, How Wall Street Traders Make Billions in the New Age of Crisis. It is a fascinating deep dive into the world of billion-dollar traders and high-stakes crisis predictors who strive to turn extreme events into financial windfalls. Today, Scott shared the genesis of his book, and introduced some of the fascinating characters that readers can get to know. We talked about the increasing focus on chaos, crisis, and market crashes, with Scott highlighting some of the most distressing financial moments of the past 30, 40 years. Scott shed light on a unique aspect of options as explained by Nassim Taleb, one of his book's main characters. We delve into the concept of black swans and dragon kings that are featured in the book. We discussed how traditional risk metrics like value at risk often fail during crisis situations. We then shifted gears and Scott shared his thoughts about the interconnectedness of financial markets, climate change, and long-term generational risk. In a lighter moment, Scott spoke about the high number of his characters who ride fast cars or motorcycles, jokingly questioning if there's a hidden correlation worth noting. Last but not least, we talk about value investing, Warren Buffett, who Scott has covered as a reporter for many years. Please help me welcome Scott Patterson. Well, hello, Scott. Nice to see you. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
You wrote a wonderful book. You wrote a few, but the most recent one is called Chaos Kings: How Wall Street Traders Make Billions in the New Age of Crisis. And I have quite a few questions for you about the book. So as I mentioned to you, we managed money for families, long-term patient disciplined approach. And now and then there are moments of chaos and distress. And there's a handful of traders that seem to be doing better than others. So you feature them in your book. And I think there are a few lessons that we can all learn from it. Before we talk about your book, I always like to start those conversations talking about childhood and upbringing, if you indulge me. And I'm curious about how you think that time influenced your relationship with money and led you on the career path that you're on, writing about some interesting characters out there in the world.
Well, my father was in the Navy, so we moved around a lot when I was a kid. So I got used to moving to new places, meeting new people. And I think that's probably helped me in my journalistic career a little bit. But I was never a person who was in school and college that interested in finance. I have a master's of English degree. So it's, I think I bring a bit of a unique perspective to Wall Street. When you read English books, you sort of learn about the different kinds of human nature, how a lot of books are about how people have all these problems. They're not rational.
Right.
And so when I started working on Wall Street, covering Wall Street, I learned about things like rational expectations, the idea that everybody is behaving rationally and that's all priced into the market automatically. And it seemed not very intuitive to me that was accurate. To me, I think about markets as being full of greed and fear. And right. These are not rational things. And the market doesn't behave rationally, especially in times of crisis. And I think that's why Nassim Taleb's books appealed to me. I first read Fooled by Randomness in the early 2000s before he was a household name. Mm-hmm. And that came from covering hedge funds, and the book was sort of among the hedge fund community, it was very popular. It wasn't a bestseller, wasn't widely known, but I heard about it through hedge fund guys who talked a lot about it. They really loved it. And Nassim in that book he's talking about how there's all sorts of perverse behaviors in financial markets. So I read the book. Then I heard, there was also a rumor going around that his hedge fund had shut down, Empirica. It wasn't confirmed. When hedge funds shut down, they don't put out a press release. They just kind of go away. So I knew some people who knew Nassim. I got in touch with him, and he actually confirmed for me that Empirica had shut down in 2004. This is in 2007. That it had never been reported. So I was the first to report that Empirica had shut down. And also in the same article that a new hedge fund called Universa was launching, and Mark Spitznagel, and it seems partner at Empirica, would be launching that hedge fund. I mean, I also talked about how this new book called The Black Swan was coming out. And that's how I got to know Mark and Nassim. So I've known them for quite a long time.
So I have a big question how the book came about, but you kind of hinted, but if you can tell us more, and maybe you can introduce all the major characters in the book. You introduced just two, and maybe you can give the audience a bit of a background on the characters that we can discover in the book.
Yeah, sure. Well, the main narrative is told through Mart Spitznagel, who's the manager of Universa, a hedge fund based in Miami. They've had some big headline successes over the years. People have probably read about them. And Nassim Taleb. And I go all the way back to the 80s, where they both started trading, Mark at the Chicago Board of Trade in Chicago, and Nassim in New York. I go through various anecdotes of episodes in the markets where there's a lot of volatility, and the people around them do very poorly. But right. they're discovering these strategies that actually do very well in volatility periods. So I take that, you know, that story up through the founding of Empirica, this tiny, kind of a tiny hedge fund, but very unique. It's really the first tail hedge fund ever created. The idea behind it was other hedge funds could invest in it, and that would protect them when there was big periods of volatility. So it was never designed to be a strategy that you could just put all your money in. It was designed to be kind of an insurance policy. So I go through their story up to they shut it down in 2004, as I just explained, and then relaunched Universa in 2007. And I go through various episodes with Universa and how it did in 2008, especially did very well. That's kind of what put them on the map. It was very fortuitous timing for both Nassim and Mark because Nassim published The Black Swan in 2007. And right around the corner, you've got the global financial crisis. And in his book, he's talking about how Wall Street doesn't manage risk very well. It uses the bell curve in its risk strategies. That's not really how things work. He had discovered long before the book came out that there are these extreme events that happen that aren't really quantifiable. And I talk about how he, in the early 2000s, he had met Benoit Mandelbrot, the founder of a fractal theory. And Mandelbrot had been discovering similar episodes in his studies of financial markets where things just go bonkers. they don't fit within normal mathematical quantifying metrics. So they kind of teamed up together and the Black Swan is actually dedicated to Mandelbrot. So he was a big influence.
At the beginning of the book, you share a recent story of Bill Ackman in early 2020. And maybe you can share it with us here, how at the time where we were all looking at what's happening with the world around us, we were going to lockdowns, we had to stay at home. Bill Ackman actually played one bet in going into this moment of big distress and then started to go long and actually buy into the market as it was about to recover. And a lot of people shared with me at the time his interview that he gave at the time, and it looked like the world was about to end. Can you walk us through those days? Because I remember those very vividly.
Yeah, the infamous CNBC interview was Scott Wapner. That's what you're referring to. But well before that, in January of 2020, Ackman had been looking at some of the reporting about how contagious COVID was, and he became very alarmed because he, like Nassim, is an expert in extreme events, studying the underlying mathematical properties. And he realized that COVID could be exponential, which means it can spread very quickly. So he started talking to people within his own hedge fund, Pershing Square. None of them agreed with him that it needed to be taken seriously. He talked to a bunch of CEOs around Wall Street. Nobody shared his concerns. He even told me that he had emailed Warren Buffett and told him that he was going to have to shut down. He was going to have to do his annual meeting in the next few months remotely. Buffett mm-hmm. didn't believe him. So he started realizing that this coming wave of death and destruction was not priced into the markets. He was looking at bond. He started looking at bond indexes, and they were not reflecting any risk. And I remember at the time, I didn't have the concern. My concern was that COVID would disrupt China economically, and that could spread to the rest of the financial system. So I did have concerns that this COVID event would result in some economic distress, but I did not think it was coming here. I even remember talking to a healthcare reporter at the Wall Street Journal, and he was dismissive of it.
Right.
So very few people saw it coming that early in January. And I also tell a story about how Nassim Taleb also was very concerned and actually wrote a paper mm-hmm. about the coming risk in January. Mm-hmm. I found it interesting that these two financial experts and also experts in extreme events were able to see this thing coming well before most people, even epidemiologists, were not really that concerned. The WHO was telling people not to take it too seriously. Part of that was trying to manage people's reaction and not get them to freak out.
Mm-hmm.
But what Bill and Nassim were saying is that people should freak out. They should panic because this thing is going to be very serious. So what Ackman did was he started buying CDS indexes. They're swaps, basically, on indexes of bonds. He bought a whole bunch of them. They were very cheap. His whole trade cost him $26 million. And then as the risk started getting priced into those bonds, they went parabolic. Mm-hmm. That $26 million bet turned into about $2.6 billion. Within the course of about a month and a half, it was just a phenomenal trade. And then, like you said, he then, in the midst of the panic, when the market was collapsing, he cashed out those trades and plunged the cash back into stocks, which was, as I say in the book, this is the first chapter of the book. It's called Hell is Coming,
right? Which is
something that he said on his CNBC interview. It was crazy. It was a crazy thing to do. I mean, it was smart. Obviously, it worked out very well. But in the midst of the panic, he recognizes that this literally, the Baron von Rothschild, buy when there's blood on the streets. That's what he did. And he made another billion on that trade. So $3.6 billion. Pretty good.
Well, there's the saying with the blood on the streets, and somebody added that make sure it's not your blood.
But yeah. I know. I mean, it could have gone the other way for him. I think his bet was, well, if I'm wrong, it's not going to matter anyway, because everything is just going to blow up.
So moments of distress like this, and this is not the first one and probably not the last one, and you describe multiple of them, the dot-com bubble, the 1987 crash, obviously the financial crisis, so at least three or four that you feature in your book. The distress itself doesn't last too long, right? So he really had a short period of time to cash out and decide what he wants to do next. So I think it's a theme that it doesn't last too long. The interesting thing that I was reading in your book, and I think it will help the audience understand what we're talking about in terms of the linear, the exponential, and how mostly options derivatives pay off. And you have this story of Taleb, how he discovered options as a student or as a researcher at some point, and was very curious how they have a non-linear payoff. And somewhere else in your book, you explain how it almost works like a fire insurance that pays triple the value of your home. Can you walk us through that so that the audience can grasp better the concept of how this kind of really insurance can work in moments of true distress?
Yeah, it's what both Mark and Nassim discovered, just sort of from talking to them, they were just sort of experimenting with different strategies in the 80s and 90s. And these big events would happen, like Black Monday in 1987. Mm-hmm. And the payoffs to those trades were exponential, super exponential, you might say, because these were contracts that were bought for pennies that would then pay off 10,000 times the value. And that's what happened, or more. That's what happened to Seam on Black Monday, or actually the day after Black Monday.
Mm-hmm.
Mark was discovering similar things, characteristics of various derivative contracts, options, swaps. And then when they met in the late 90s, when Nassim was teaching at NYU, it was a meeting of the minds. They both had sort of discovered similar properties in these contracts. And it's what Mark describes as crash bang insurance. That these contracts, and I think I tell the story about in 2010 when we had the flash crash.
Right.
Contracts that Universa had bought for $2 went up to $60.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of thing that they're talking about. That is not a normal return that you get for almost any kind of trade on Wall Street. The downside of the strategy is that usually those don't work. They expire worthless. Mm-hmm. So you bleed. That's the word they use, is bleeding. And that can go on for months or years. And that's not the way that normal most investors trade. They are usually looking for pretty steady returns, low volatility. You don't get the big exponential gains, but you're not losing money all the time. And that strategy looks very bad according to predominant market theories that say if you're losing a lot year after year, that's a very bad strategy. So that they had a hard time selling it. So, you know, Universa, when it launched, they had a couple investors in the beginning, traveled the US, they went to Europe, they met with hundreds of different investors, and over the course of the first year, not a single investor put money into the fund. And this is 2007 and early 2008, when things were pretty rocky. You would think that this would be kind of an appealing strategy, but it just doesn't fit within the normal framework that most investors use.
So the characters in your book, they were buyers of this insurance, but you also mentioned the sellers of this insurance, right? So because nothing bad happens for so long, you can actually collect money writing those options or those CDSs, those derivatives. Yep. And it seems like a very attractive strategy for a long time, because it almost feels like printing money.
Free money, yeah.
Free money. It's you're taking on a risk that you don't see until it comes. Mm-hmm. And then the third part to it is, I would call it the casino, the institutions that facilitate the trade. And I'll come back to it. But I'm curious about the sellers of this insurance. What happens to them in moments of distress? You have some examples in your book.
They blow up, is what happens.
In a spectacular way.
They can blow up in a day.
Uh-huh.
It's quite astonishing. And yeah, I have some examples in 2020 of some hedge funds that were engaging in that strategy. Probably, potentially, they were counterparties to Universa. And yeah, it's the proverbial nickel in front of the steamroller. You're picking up the nickel. It's free. It's keep on picking up the nickels until one day you slip and the steamroller rolls right over you. It's a dangerous strategy. It looks good. It does fit within that framework of very steady returns day after day, year after year. It looks good on paper. But then that day comes, who knew that the market would be crashing, the Dow would be crashing 2,000 points a day.
Right.
In early 2020, things had looked pretty good. The economy was doing well. But yeah, I mean, Nassim talks about hidden risk and strategies, and this is something that fits within that. It's hidden. You can't really see it looking at the returns, because the returns look great. low volatility. But then one day it all ends, and it can end quite suddenly. And this is also what happened in 2008 to a lot of hedge funds that had been counterparties to those traders like Paulson making the big short. They were selling credit default swaps. Then when the market crashed and the housing market crashed, they had to pay up. And that's really what brought down all the banks, was they were short volatility. They were, and then somebody like Paulson is long volatility.
So you have the two sides, the buyer and the seller of the contract. And then you have the financial institutions. I mean, for the image or simplicity here, it's a casino in that sense. There are two different sides of the bet. And what happened during the financial crisis, what could have happened was that you might have been right about what's going to happen and your contract would have gone up in price. But whoever is on the other side could have been no longer there financially to make good on the promise that the contract defined. And when you really think about it, you're betting on a distress and a crisis, but not a complete end of the world. Because if it was a true end of the world, even if you're intellectually right about the bet, there's no more casino to take the money out from.
Yeah.
Am I right? I mean, that's how I looked at it.
Well, what some of the firms engaging this strategy do is they will also buy swaps on the bank.
Uh-huh.
So if the bank fails, they'll get paid off from that trade. Of course, you're hoping whoever is the counterparty for that trade is still around. I think that's the doomsday scenario. And in that scenario, we're basically going back to the Stone Age, which we were pretty close there in 2008. The Fed stepped in and backstopped all the banks. But yeah, that's the default. Nassim has told me about trades that he's made over the years where he would short the financial institution that was a counterparty to his volatility trades.
All those trades need a counterparty. There's always somebody on the other side, right? So you hope that somebody
will. You don't
want
complete Armageddon.
No.
You're going to mini Armageddon.
No. And if anything we've learned from the last few crises that we've had is, don't count on the help of the government, but don't underestimate it, because if it comes, it can really distort the picture and the pricing of assets and the zero rate policy and how the junk bonds were actually trading after the 2020 crash. They didn't really reflect the risk that was happening. So that's fascinating to look at. You introduced some terms that I found interesting, and some of them I'm familiar with, some of them less so. So you talk about black swans, and I think we'd be curious to talk about it briefly, introduce the idea. And then you talk about dragon kings, as opposed to the chaos kings that you write about in the book. Can you tell us what they are?
Yeah, dragon kings is a term created by this French mathematician, physicist, Didier Sornet. Mm-hmm. And it's his version of the black swan. He came up with it after the black swan book came out. He didn't like the black swan. He thinks that the concept provides risk takers an excuse when things go contrary to what they expected. That, oh, it was a black swan. I could never have seen it. This was totally unexpected. What Didier claims is that, no, actually these things are predictable in using very complicated math. And he's designed strategies that he claims can predict when something is entering a bubble, which prevailing economic theory claims that you cannot predict when something is in a bubble. You can only see it after it's popped. He developed this method in the 1990s when he was studying basically eruptions of rockets, detecting these little signals within the rocket that start moving very, very quickly and is an indication that something is going to blow up. He used that method and started looking at stocks, financial markets. He briefly was with a hedge fund that was using it. And then he ended up going to an institute in Zurich where he launched the Financial Crisis Observatory, where he's testing this on all sorts of instruments, financial instruments around the world, on currencies and bonds, stocks, and was refining the strategy over the years. The success of it, as I get into the book, is it's tricky because it does seem like his system can detect when things are entering bubbles. Mm-hmm. What's hard is figuring out when to trade on that, because it's a bubble can just keep going. As we know, it's very, very hard to tell when it's going to blow up. So he did some tests that I talk about where he made predictions on various instruments and commodities, said they're in a bubble, and then he unveiled those publicly, and it looked like he was correct in detecting bubbles in these certain bonds, or I think sugar was one of them. But it didn't look like he was, because he would say, okay, this thing is up 10% or 20%. Is it time to short? The problem was they kept going up. Some did go down a little bit, but then they rebounded and they went up a lot more. So it's a fascinating study and prediction from somebody who's very smart, but it's just hard to do. And I liked using Didier because he's sort of a counterpoint to the Universa Spitznagel-Taleb strategy. Mm-hmm. And what they say is, we can't predict anything. We have no idea. It is more of a black swan mentality that we know these things happen. We just don't know when. And so we put on a permanent short, basically. Mm-hmm. Whereas Didier is more of a speculator. He's trying to trade advantageously, and that's just hard to do. And I came across a YouTube video of a debate between Seem and Didier in, I forget, 2014 or 2013, it provides a really interesting perspective on how they view things differently. And that's obviously a scene in the book.
So when I heard the term Dragon Kings, I was thinking of telltales, a way to see that something is coming. And I'm thinking of the weather. I sail and I surf, and I noticed that if you spend enough time on the water, you start to see that you'll know that the squall is coming. You don't know if it's going to be bad or not, but there are certain telltales, the way the birds behave, the way the wind dies down, there's something coming. And the safe thing to do is to get out of the water or hide somewhere.
Yeah.
And I wish the markets were the same. I wish they had reliable telltales. And I think it was Feynman, the physicist, that said, can you imagine physics if electrons had feelings? And I think that sums it up, because in the market, there's the logic, there's the intellect, there's the technical side to it, but then there are the emotions. And I think that the emotions are very hard to measure, both on the way up and on the way down. But speaking of that, there's something interesting in your book, an observation about, we're talking about sudden crashes and sudden moments of a correction. But what if we have a period, which you write about, when the market just slowly, inch by inch, drops and corrects itself, but not in a sudden way? A lot of those strategies fail to deliver. Can you talk about that?
This is a question that came up when the Universe was meeting with the California pension fund CalPERS. And they asked him, what happens if you don't get a sudden correction or crash, if the market just slowly grinds lower and lower day after day, month after month? Well, what happens to your strategy? And Mark concedes it doesn't work in that environment. That's the one environment where the strategy doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
But what he told them is that, well, that's the perfect environment for you anyway, because you can get out. That gives you time to exit the market. Most crashes happen so quickly that you can't exit. It's just too fast. Everybody's trying to get out at once. That's what causes the crash. And that's why markets crash. it creates a panic effect where everybody is racing for the exit. They can't all fit out at once, and you don't have a chance to exit your trade. And that slow grind lower, I don't think I've ever seen it. It's just really not how markets decline. They tend to, these black swan events tend to happen very fast. There's just something about financial markets. You don't see that happen on the upside. I mean, sometimes there's bubbles. I was around in 1999 and 2000. That was pretty nuts. I remember watching the dot-com stocks just go up 20% a day. That's pretty rare. What's more common is the sudden crash. And in those situations, the strategy of buying these far out of the money options, put options, works pretty well.
I like to call it the escalator on the way up and the elevator on the way down. And the experience that I've seen from two decades of investing in the public markets. And I remember how in 2020 in March, I believe that we lost 3 years of gains in 3 weeks or so. So it gives you the proportion of how quickly things can change. And I think it's the human nature that we don't panic one person at a time. Somehow we panic all together at the same time. And sometimes in the market, there's just one door out, as you hinted, and then there might be not enough liquidity to get out of certain trades. And that's something worth remembering. And that brings me to another question, which something that you bring up in your book, which is the correlation during extreme events. And Taleb writes about it, and you talk about it extensively, how people look at correlations and they feel safe in certain assets, but they look at the correlations through a long period of time that may or may not include an extreme event. And if so, it's a brief event that doesn't really affect the metric. But in those extreme moments, and I'm thinking specifically as an example, December 2018, we had a bit of a crash. And I remember a chart, a table that showed that actually the correlation across all assets was very, very high. So it didn't really matter if you were in equities, in bonds, what kind of bonds. People were selling everything. And it was a refresher to me that in moments of distress, there are only sellers in the market. Can you talk about that? How he makes a point, you make a point, how the value at risk measures that people use and the false sense of diversification and lack of correlation doesn't work in an extreme event.
Yeah. What people tend to say is correlations go to one and crashes. So the idea is that if you're in one asset class that's doing well, something else isn't doing well, they balance one another out.
Right.
And there are all sorts of strategies. This is how hedge funds work. This is how Wall Street works, right? It's like looking at these historical correlations and trying to get this optimal mix of things that will reduce volatility, give you pretty good returns. But as you say, when there's a panic, everybody sells everything and that volatility bleeds across asset classes. So it's one thing, it's another. And all of a sudden, everything is going down. Bonds are going down. And it's because banks, hedge funds have these risk metrics. So if, say, your stocks are crashing, you need to reduce your exposure to the market. You don't want to sell your stocks because you're hoping that they're going to go back up. Mm-hmm. So you sell your bond portfolio or some of your bond portfolio. And that's how things technically bleed into one another on balance sheets. So it doesn't work. And Mark Spitznagel has done extensive research on all these strategies, looked at them over time. None of them really work very well, especially in crashes. So an important point to make for investors about the way that a universal strategy works is, and why Mark doesn't depend on crashes for it to work, is that what they recommend is investors put about 3% of their assets into the universal strategy. Mm-hmm. The rest they put into stocks. That's their recommendation, is put into stocks, put S&P 500 or a portfolio of stocks you like. And that gives you much more exposure to the stock market, which over time, historically, does better, has higher returns than bonds. And it also allows you, when there is a crash, you don't have to sell your stocks because you're protected by the universal strategy. So you can hold on. The strategy that most firms use, just sort of generically, is the 60-40 strategy, which is 60% in stocks, 40% in bonds. That has some periods where it's done okay. It's done terribly the last few years. I think 2002 might have been the worst period of all time for 60-40. But the problem with that that Mark identifies is you were reducing your exposure to the stock market. It's what really matters for returns by putting all of that and hiding your cash in bonds, or it can be Swiss francs or even gold. I think they kind of like gold. They have that libertarian love of the shiny gold medal. But so that's an important point to make about the universal strategy, is that he says he would be fine if the market never, he'd be happy if the market never crashed again, because that would get his clients would continue to make money with the market going up. He doesn't think that's what's going to happen. He actually is expecting a huge crash. He's a bit of a perma bear, but it doesn't require a crash for his clients to do well. I think that's an important point.
I think the saying goes that the best insurance is the one you don't actually need. And yeah, that's how I would think about it. So managing money for families, second best thing we can do is we let the cash go up or down in different periods of time. And it has really helped soften the blow in the moments of correction, gave us dry powder to buy things. And in March of 2020, we were buying some stocks at a 20-year low, which was remarkable to see. It wasn't a long window. I was honestly thinking it will be a much longer window. That's why I mentioned before, don't expect the government to help, but don't underestimate their help if they do come, because they will distort the market very quickly. But that's the second best thing that one can do. You write in the book not just about the financial markets. You expand the topic to other crises we might be facing. You talk about the climate, the planet. And I like that quote from your book, which really resonates with the way we think, because we manage money over generations. You say that modern humans seem to have lost the ability to think about generational risk. And it really made me pause. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. This was a letter that the glam rocker Brian Eno wrote to Nassim in 2013 or 14. And yeah, he is making the point that it seems like humanity is focusing a lot on the current moment, the quarterly report, the annual report. You see this in financial markets a lot, where for traders, the incentive is to focus on your 1 year gain and the bonus that you get. And Eno is saying this is something that's affecting humanity as a whole.
Right.
He uses the example of the nuclear meltdown at Fukushima, which didn't kill anybody. Mm-hmm. But what it did do was cause Japan to move away from nuclear and build a bunch of coal-fired power plants,
right,
which are very bad for the climate. So to mitigate this kind of potential risk that didn't really materialize, they're doing something that is very bad for humanity long-term. Mm-hmm. And this is, with climate, we certainly see that there is a complete failure to recognize the risks that we're posing to future generations. We focus on the economic hardship it would take to shut down fossil plants, instead of thinking about how we're actually sucking away the economic gains from future generations. And it's why this is the case. It's hard to say. Have things really changed? Eno thinks that humanity used to think generationally, and he has some interesting examples about like growing trees to replace rotting wooden cathedrals, which is pretty interesting. It's hard to say if it's true that things that humanity has ever really been not focused on the next hunt or the next growing season. I mean, maybe it has, but we definitely are in a situation now where it seems, and the climate is the perfect example, that leaders they're focusing on elections. That's another thing. Short-term thinking is not, because what happens to the next generation, people talk about like they care about it, but it's not going to affect their election. So political leaders are definitely affected by this short-termism. So I think what the challenge is to try to break us out of this inability to take actions that may not help us immediately, but will help humanity in the long run. And even that idea that taking action on climate won't help us in the short term is pretty myopic, because there are a lot of things being developed now, technologies that actually will help us break our addiction to fossil fuels and all of the problems that come along with it, like what we see with what Russia is doing and all these sort of malevolent petrostates. Take away the power that gives them the ability to act like that, like the way they do, it could bring pretty swift positive responses. And cheap power is just a good thing. It's solar now is cheaper than any other energy in the world. So it seems to make a lot of sense short term, as well as long term, to invest in this stuff.
Yeah, I think there's some optimistic things happening at the same time. Combining our conversation about COVID and the planet, I was reading so many articles in 2020 how we've done more for the planet in that 1 year than we've done in a long time, because we stopped moving around. We were not driving. We were not flying. And the footprint that we've created was much smaller. I remember one specific story in New York, how the snowy owl came to Central Park for the first time in 130 years because the city was so quiet. And it's an owl that doesn't like noise or attention or any distraction. And it came to Central Park for the first time in 130 years. And I thought, wow. And it's one of many, many stories about fish in the canals of Venice and so on and so on.
Right.
Cities in India where people for the first time from their rooftops could see the mountains, because it's always so smoggy and cloudy and they can't see through the pollution. So there were those moments where I thought, oh, maybe we're doing more by doing less.
Right. Yeah, I remember that. I remember stories about seismologists who were actually able to detect things in the Earth's crust better than they ever had been before because there was less noise. So yeah, it was a pretty remarkable time. Unsustainable. Unfortunately, the economy was basically, global economy was being kept alive on steroids and fiscal stimulus. But yeah, there was this sort of feeling of dread mixed with wonder and amazement at how quiet things had gotten on the streets around us. And and then the ability to stay home and have dinner with your family.
Of course.
And people don't want to give that up.
No, very true. I hope that some of those things will stay with us. Remote work, not flying coast to coast just to a lunch meeting, which was happening before. I think people are more rational about how they spend time and money, and in some ways at least. And I think that there is some difference that we can make and learn from this experience. I don't think we're going to go as extreme as shut down the world just to save the planet. I don't know if that's the path. I want to ask you a cheeky question about motorcycles and fast cars. In your book, there are so many stories of the characters you introduce that are driving fast motorcycles or cars. Is there a correlation? Something we should pay attention to?
Well, Didier is the motorcycle guy. And he likes going very fast, scary fast, 170 miles an hour. He told me a story about how he once drove on he's got these super bikes from Zurich to Rome in a day, a trip that usually takes several days, going 170 miles an hour. And he will draw a correlation between driving super fast and trading and risk management strategies and trying to, you manage the risk with the helmet. You try to see what's coming up ahead and take actions to avert risk. I think going 170 miles an hour, that helmet's not going to help much.
No.
But yeah, and then Mark Spitznagel, he got into some what I would consider risky activities. Like, I guess what it's called wind sailing, where you ride these engineless planes on drifts. He was doing this when they were based out in California. You would never catch me doing that. But they like skateboarding around Central Park. There was one episode where Mark almost got run over by a taxi because he crashed at a stoplight. It's hard to say. I mean, Nassim, you would never catch him going 170 miles an hour, much less riding a motorcycle. He wouldn't even. He's very risk averse. He does everything he can to minimize his physical exposure. He does ride bicycles a lot and sometimes around the cities, and some people consider that kind of risky.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if I'm trying to make a point. I think some of it just kind of like makes for interesting reading. It gives the characters some color.
I think there is some very mild correlation, and it made me think of, do you know the term ergodicity and Luca Dalana's work? The idea that not the fastest skier, you don't have to be the fastest skier, but the one that gets to participate in all the races without breaking a leg and being among the surviving fastest.
Yeah.
And not having game overs basically in any pursuit in life as much as you can. And I'm thinking that some of those trading policies, practices might have a game over, especially if you're on the other side of it and you're the one selling insurance. And
gambler's racing, ruin.
complete ruin. And then if you're racing from Zurich to Rome in a day, I think you are accepting some risks that maybe are not worth taking, but that's a personal choice, something to think about. But I think the idea of risk, the metrics and all that, but it's a very personal perception of risks. At our firm, we like to actually live through a downturn and a bull market with a new client, because everything else is very hypothetical, how they react to different markets, but to actually see them and their emotions through different settings and backdrops so that we can actually see how are we on the same page in terms of how we think about risk. Very quickly, Mark mentions Buffett Munger Graham's school of thought. So he's not in favor of a lot of the traditional asset allocation policies, but he has a weak spot for the value investors, that a school that I subscribe to. Can you talk about that? Why do we get a pass in Mark's world of investing?
Yeah, I mean, a few people would look at what they do and think, oh, that's just like what Warren Buffett does. But the way he sees it is the options that he buys are value trades because they're undervalued. They're Buffett's cigar butts that he likes to talk about. You get one last puff out of it when everybody else is throwing it away. So that's in a nutshell, that's it. He's saying, I'm buying stuff nobody else in their right mind thinks has any value. I do think it has value, so it's a value trade. It also, you said earlier how it's sort of like insurance. Berkshire Hathaway, the engine behind Berkshire Hathaway is its insurance arm, which provides the steady flow of cash that Buffett uses to buy stuff, especially in crashes. He's very adept at not panicking, doing what Ackman did in 2020 and buying. You remember in 2008, 2009, he was investing in banks I actually know Buffett. I covered Berkshire Hathaway for the Wall Street Journal for a couple of years, and he was very proud of his $5 billion investment in Goldman Sachs, which we all remember. It kind of helped stabilize things. Right. And he'd actually calculated down to the minute how much money he was making from Goldman Sachs. He told me about that one time. So yeah, it's universes. Mark sees it as a value investment that just pays off rarely, but when it does, it's enormous and makes up for all the losses that they had incurred over the years.
So since you had a personal experience both with Buffett and the characters in your book, are the personalities similar or different? In what ways? I'm curious about your perspective, because you see the parallels, but they're very different people when you think about it.
Yeah. Well, they're contrarians, right? I mean, and that's kind of what you need to be if you're a value investor, is you're buying stuff that everybody else thinks is junk. Sometimes it is junk. But, you know, if you've done your analysis, you've looked at the balance sheet, if you understand that people are missing something, then you can do well. Their personalities are, I mean, Mark is, he's very obsessed with constantly looking at the market. He's just trained like a laser on it. He doesn't really, I mean, he has some outside activities, but he's just, he was born to be a trader. That's all he wants to do. Nassim is different. He doesn't want to be known as a trader or a Wall Street guy at all. He wants to be known as a scientist and philosopher, a writer of books. And I think he's succeeded at that. So Buffett is, he once told me that I had written a couple books post-financial crisis, and I'd mentioned to him that I was writing a new one and I was going to be leaving the journal for a little bit. And he told me he always wanted to write a book, but he never got around to it. He's a trader. He's born to be a trader. He's not a philosopher. He's got some philosophical ideas, I guess, but he also has a remarkable memory. I remember him telling me about investments that he'd made in the 1960s in extreme detail, how I forget what it was, but it just kind of blew my mind that he remembered this investment so in so much detail and so thoroughly.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. I saw the two of them in Omaha this year, and I'm really impressed, and I hope I am as capable mentally, intellectually, when I'm their age, and the stamina to sit for hours and answer questions in a very fun way.
Yeah, Curly Munger is a phenomenon.
Incredible people. Scott, I have one last question for you. I like to ask about success and definition of success, your own. How do you think about it? Is it a destination, a journey? And you can talk more about the professional writing and personal life, whichever one you want to share.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a journalist, a reporter, and success is measured almost on a daily basis where you're constantly trying to come up with new stories, new ideas, or even for books. So it's definitely more the journey. Right now I'm writing about climate and energy and climate technology, and I find it really fascinating what's going on. I think that most people don't really realize the enormity of the transition that the world is going through and is going to go through. I like learning about new things and talking to interesting people like Buffett and Nassim Taleb. So I really enjoy the work. It's hard. You do a story, it goes out, and your editors want to know what's coming next.
It never stops.
You never get to rest on your laurels. It's interesting and fun. And I spent 5 years in London covering the mining industry. I got to travel all over the place, in Africa, South America. So that's really fun stuff. It's a good job. So yeah, I've enjoyed it.
And I know that we have a mutual friend, William Green, that also read your book, reviewed your book, and yeah, he's a wonderful person. I mean, just like you, curious about the world, and you both have a way of introducing us to sometimes very complicated ideas in a way that's more accessible. So thank you for that. And speaking of energy, I hope that what you're finding out is optimistic, that there is a way out and there's a better future for all of us, because I think as a society, as the whole planet, we're going to consume more and more energy, especially when you think about emerging markets and so much of the population that's consuming right now a fraction of what we consume in the US. If we're all to match it, we definitely have to find more creative ways to source energy. But I'm looking forward to reading that. Is it going to be a book or an article?
It could be. I mean, I've written a bunch of articles about it, the different technologies. And speaking of Berkshire Hathaway, I've been reporting on a story about a factory in West Virginia that they're building that's going to make titanium, and they're going to power it with solar and batteries, which is really interesting. So even Buffett he's getting on the climate technology bandwagon. But I think you go covering climate, you go through periods of just complete despair, but then there's optimism when you see the scale of what people are doing, and it's a money story, it's an investing story, it's a finance story, because these things are going to replace the current infrastructure of energy. It's going to take decades, but it's coming, and it's just kind of mind-blowing how big it is. It's going to be.
Well, I hope it's all optimistic. At the end of the day, we have just one planet to live on. So I think we really have to take good care of it. It's the only home we have, or at least we found so far. Scott, thank you so much for today. Thank you for being so generous with your time. It's a wonderful book, and I'll include all the links in the notes. And I think a lot of people would enjoy it. It gives a new perspective on the world we live in, where we're going to have more moments of distress, chaos, and crises. And it's good to know how we can handle it and what's the best way to go about it and what we can learn from the past examples that you share in the book. So thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Been interesting.
You were listening to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment and follow, subscribe, rate, and share with friends and family. We rely on word of mouth to promote the show. One click for you means the world to us. Thank you. Until next time, your host, Bogumil Baranowski. The content of this podcast is for general informational purposes only, and so are the opinions of members of Sicard Associates, a registered investment advisor, and guests of the show. This podcast does not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any specific security or financial instruments, or provide investment advice or service. Past performance is not indicative of future results. More information on Sicard Associates is available in its Form ADV disclosure documents, available at advisorinfo.sec.gov.